Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. On Wednesday night, a 28-year-old Marine veteran used a Glock 21, which is a 45-caliber semi-automatic handgun, to shoot and kill 12 people. Many were college students dancing in the Borderline Bar and Grill in Thousand Oaks, California. USA Today and a few other media outlets report that the sale and possession of that gun is illegal in California, but a federal court blocked the law. In 2016, California voters approved a proposition in the wake of the San Bernardino shooting, which made it illegal to possess magazines capable of holding more than 10 rounds. But before that new law could take effect, it was blocked by a federal judge after a lawsuit by the California Rifle and Pistol Association, the state NRA affiliate. This is the 307th mass shooting in the United States. This year, there's been a deadly shooting almost every single day in this country. We did not plan to talk about shootings on today's roundtable, but since this happened, we wanted to spend some time on it. Later in the show, we're going to talk about the midterm elections, and we'll talk about how U.S. economic sanctions on Iran have affected Iranians. Joining us now is Zach Carter, a senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post. Hi, Zach. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rose.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Eric Pape, a veteran journalist, freelance writer, adjunct instructor at USC's Annenberg School. He's overseeing Capital and Maine's special project on the cost of living in California. And if you're not familiar with Capital and Maine, find the link to his stories at yourcallradio.org. They do excellent reporting. Hi, Eric. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Good morning.
Well, Eric, we are coughing up here in San Francisco. I woke up this morning, the kitchen was just smelling like smoke. You're in Southern California. It's burning up here and it's burning down there. Just in the last hour, Malibu, California, has been evacuated. Where are you located exactly?
I'm located at the border of Culver City and Mid-City. It's pretty much right in the center of Los Angeles, and I could actually see a little haze peeking over the Santa Monica Mountain.
Wow.
That doesn't look like our normal morning haze.
It's just so sad. I mean, it's the town of Paradise, which is right outside of Chico, northeast of San Francisco, is completely gone. Just gone.
So, yeah. We are in a strange moment with these fires, and there seem to be our fire season seems to be a little more noticeable, more extreme, and more destructive each year in the last few years.
Do you have anything to say about the media coverage of these fires? We've done so many shows about climate change and fires and just the lack of funding. What needs to happen in order to at least try to prevent so much devastation? Because these get national attention, as they should. But what do you think about the coverage?
The coverage of fires, I mean, we see the panic at the moment that fires happen. The nature of news is that it covers what's new, and what's new and shocking is the extent of these fires and how frequent they seem to be coming and how destructive they seem to be coming. I mean, growing up in Los Angeles as I did, fires were a part of the reality of Malibu. I don't remember a lot of times when two-thirds of Malibu were suddenly evacuated on such little notice.
Wow.
I grew up Part of my very young childhood, I went to school in Thousand Oaks, and it's an area that right now I would expect to be extremely vulnerable, very dry, mountainous terrain that would be very hard to protect for firefighters. So the coverage, I think the challenge of the news coverage, though, is to remind people when the fires aren't there what can be done, and to not get caught up in the moment and then to forget in between fire seasons, when we can actually do things that might help to respond.
Exactly. I mean, there's so many angles here. There's climate change. There's insurance. There's PTSD. There's so much. Zach, where are you located today?
I'm in Brooklyn.
Okay.
So as far away from all of this as you can be and still be in the United States. But it's a shocking to me that 2 weeks ago we were talking about a different mass shooting. Circumstances are very different in both of them, but it really does feel like, I don't want to be too dramatic, but I get this feeling of just like social dysfunction, almost like social collapse. Like, what country has shootings like this just a couple weeks apart? And in Brooklyn, at least, the Thousand Oaks shooting feels kind of like a normal news event at this point, like something that you expect to happen in the United States. And there's something about that that wasn't always the case in my life. You know, I remember when Columbine happened, that was a shocking thing. And they shut down school for, I was still in high school when that happened. They shut down my school in, you know, in the Northern Virginia suburbs of Washington, D.C. for a couple of days. In response to that, it was a major event of national trauma, and now it's almost like it's something that we are accustomed to.
Can we just talk about this for a minute? How do you think this should be covered? Because I feel like on the radio, for example, I mean, even NPR in many cases, the coverage of this shooting sounds like the coverage of the last shooting and the shooting before that. You talk to the victims' families, which of course you're going to do. You give people basic information. Yes, you have to do that. But what about the deeper issue here? I mean, there are a couple. For example, the one in Southern California, I mentioned in the intro that in 2016, voters approved a proposition to make it illegal to possess magazines capable of holding more than 10 rounds. That's the gun that this guy used. It's a 45 caliber semi-automatic handgun. But before that law could take effect, it was blocked by a judge after a lawsuit by the California Rifle and Pistol Association, which is the state NRA affiliate. And, you know, we've done so many shows about the NRA giving mostly Republicans millions and millions of dollars. So what about that angle, Zach? I think that needs to be in every single story about these shootings.
Well, I haven't read every single story about these shootings, so I'm reluctant to criticize anybody's coverage specifically. I mean, I do think it's difficult, though, for a publication to talk about gun control policy after the Sandy Hook shootings. You know, the country didn't, the government in Washington did not have a political response to a massacre of children. And if that's not going to make something happen, it's not clear what will. And I don't mean to, I don't want to fuel apathy here. But, you know, there's a sense of the common thing that all these shootings have in common is that they're shootings. So clearly the issue at stake is access to weapons that can be used to shoot. And yet politically, there, at least in Washington, as a matter of national policy, there is not any ability at the moment to do anything about that. And that makes it difficult, I think, for people who are assigned to cover these things. I myself haven't been covering this shooting, so I can't give you any special insights to the way I, you know, would cover it. But I think it's hard when these things are so commonplace, and the political response has been essentially dysfunction.
Eric, what are your thoughts?
I'd actually say it hasn't been dysfunction; it's been total inaction. I think there's actually a similarity between the fires and the shootings that are so common, and I think that it's that the shootings are treated almost like a natural disaster, where virtually nothing can be done, and I don't think it's because it's not. I think surveys show that a substantial majority of people in the country would like to see something done. I think it's because the NRA is one of the most effective, if not the most effective, lobbying organization in American history. And so it punches way, way above its weight, and it's extremely effective in Washington, and it's extremely effective in state capitals. Thousand Oaks, where the shooting took place, is often considered to be one of the safest places in the United States. And the idea that this kind of shooting can happen in a bar when people are dancing and relaxing on a, you know, one evening, I think that says something to the incredible vulnerability that people have to this sort of gun violence in the United States.
To your point, Eric, the Springfield News Sun had a piece about the NRA spending $11 million in the 2018 midterms. And a couple of the politicians who got the most money, Marsha Blackburn, congresswoman from Tennessee, John Culberson, congressman from Texas, both Republicans on the Senate side, Ted Cruz of Texas, Josh Hawley, Missouri, Dean Heller, Nevada. although Dean Heller just lost his election, that's on the Senate side. So that's a really important angle. The other important angle is that we know that the shooter was a former Marine veteran. He served in Afghanistan. A number of reports say that he may have had PTSD because he did have a history of mental health issues. This is getting some attention. And according to various reports, the last Facebook post he wrote was, quote, "I hope they call me insane. Wouldn't that just be a big ball of irony? I am insane, but the only thing you people do after these shootings is hopes and prayers or keep you in my thoughts every time and wonder why these keep happening." So, Zach, that's another angle that deserves so much more attention.
Pretty serious. But, you know, this particular mass shooting, you know, the specifics of each shooting are different. I mean, the shooting in Pittsburgh was, you know, an act of explicitly anti-Semitic terrorism. I don't know the full details of the Thousand Oaks shooter's background, and I don't feel qualified to speculate about it. But it seems clear that in both cases, without access to a weapon capable of causing mass death, these people are not capable of causing mass death. That's the common denominator on both of these, and I agree with Eric. I mean, the National Rifle Association is an incredibly effective lobby. Their agenda carries the day, and certainly in Washington D.C., where I'm used to covering politics at the state and local level, I don't have as much experience, but they're enormously powerful in Washington, and other to the detriment at the expense of other priorities when lobby groups, whether it's the NRA or whether it's a coal lobby or you know, any corporate lobby, are able to take over the agenda in Congress, it means other priorities, other problems like, say, you know, addressing mental health are not available. They're not on the agenda. And you know, we have spent a lot of time talking about health care in the United States the past 5 or 6 years, but mostly it's been, you know, it's the Republicans have obviously been trying to repeal Obamacare for several years now. But most of the Democratic Party agenda is just about consolidating access to insurance, to health insurance. It's not about what the insurance is going to cover for the most part. I mean, there are regulations in Obamacare. I don't want to get too into the weeds here. But we don't talk a lot about what the healthcare system itself is supposed to do. We talk about people getting access to the healthcare system. And I think that's, you know, those are the types of problems that you want government to address. And we don't address them.
Anything to add there, Eric? I mean, again, this should be a jumping off point. People need to do research about the background of this particular man, this 28-year-old. We do know CNN reports that his mother lived in fear of what her son might do. Democracy Now! Reports that he was evaluated by mental health professionals earlier this year after police responded to a disturbance at his home. And so, this is a jumping off point to talk about, well, how are veterans getting help when they come back? What is the status of that? We know that suicides are high.
I mean, and this is not a new problem. Each time the U.S. has a major conflict, we have plenty of people coming back from war, and they're carrying scars, and they're carrying their trauma. And when it's unresolved, it can be extremely dangerous to them, and in some cases, it can be very dangerous to other people. There is a change that I've seen over the years, which is after the war in Vietnam, the people coming back who had PTSD. And who seemed to, the small percentage of them who acted out violently, early on it felt like the violence was mostly directed towards themselves. It was much more of a straight sort of suicidal thing in the experiences that, you know, people around me had and in what I read at the time. Nowadays, we have this phenomenon that goes far beyond just those people and their PTSD. It's the phenomenon of suicide by cop, of suicide by going into a public place and hurting other people until either someone else shoots you or you shoot yourself. And there's an evolution of society in there that's very troubling. It mixes with our questions about mental illness and post-traumatic stress disorder and our absolute incapacity to deal with the scale of mental illness in this country at the same time as we have, you know, quite ready access to unbelievably powerful weapons.
Right. And also, every shooting is different, but it does say something about what's happening in our society. The man who killed two black people at a Kroger store tried to enter a predominantly black church right before that happened. That was in Kentucky recently. And then the man who shot two people at a yoga studio in Florida said horrific things about women. In fact, he was arrested for groping women and trespassing on a campus in Florida. And then you had the shooting in at the synagogue. So these are all obviously separate incidents with people who've got various problems, but it says so much about where we are as a society right now. Zach, how do you think the media should really handle that and explore those issues?
I mean, it's a big question, because I think these outbursts of violence, as you're alluding to, are an expression of a broad set of problems in society. I mean, we're talking about mental health and veterans and PTSD. You know, this is connected to, you know, why do veterans end up with PTSD in the first place? And I'm not saying that this particular shooter did or did not have PTSD, but there are major questions of military policy that are wrapped up in this particular that kind of question. And we kind of forget, I think, day to day, that the United States has been engaged in military action abroad for the majority of my lifetime, the past 17 years, and it's only a small fraction of our society that has to actually be involved in that every day. And occasionally when a violent traumatic event invades the rest of peaceful civilian life, we're reminded, oh yes, there are people who are out abroad fighting wars right now. I think there are a lot of things that are just not politically functioning correctly in the United States. There are social problems that are supposed to be addressed by the political system, and when that political system doesn't respond to those problems, you see manifestations of disorder, violence, trouble in the broader society.
What would you add, Eric?
I would add that I think that the people who are having this scale of problems, you know, mental problems that are extreme, violent tendencies, and access to, and you know, working very hard to get weapons, and I say working hard because they often amass a large number of them, which requires a lot more work than going out and getting, you know, one or two weapons opportunistically. I think that the things that stir them up and get them going, that stir up the crazy, as a friend of mine in the emergency responders world says, are things that are in our society. So there's an evolution over the years. Different things are stirring them up, and the parts of their brain that are going in these troubling directions are attaching themselves to things that are happening in the zeitgeist, things that are happening around them. And we live in a social media era where it's very easy for people to find a lot of extreme beliefs and get stirred up by them. And that brings that's sort of the newer component in here. Everything else is just troublingly enduring. And that new component is something we might need to start thinking about, because you know, the sort of hate-driven stuff that you were pointing to, I think a lot of that, not that stuff is new in the world, but that stuff's certainly new in social media, and it can give people the impression that there's a lot more people who feel the way they do, and it can push them forward and guide their actions to some extent.
Eric,
and that's very troubling.
It's very troubling. Eric Pape is a veteran journalist and an editor adjunct instructor at USC's Annenberg School. He's overseeing Capital and Maine's special project on the cost of living in California. We will talk to him about that series. Zach Carter is a senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post. And if you'd like to join us, there's just so much going on. We're going to move on and talk about the midterms, what happened there. And then later in the show, we will talk about U.S. economic sanctions on Iran. USA Today had a piece about how the people helped most by the Affordable Care Act are the ones most likely to suffer from poor mental health and addiction. 30% of those who got coverage through Medicaid expansion have a mental disorder such as anxiety or schizophrenia, or an addiction to substances such as opioids or alcohol. So really, it's great that the Democrats took back the House, because now Republicans cannot overturn the Affordable Care Act. And, I mean, we're talking about gun violence here. And, you know, even with the fires, people have PTSD. So this piece of the ACA is so incredibly important. And so that's not going to go away, we're hoping. But talking about health care, what we did see across the country is that we have now Medicaid expansion in Idaho, Nebraska, and Utah. Voters there approved Medicaid expansion. And Zach, you've been writing about this. Talk about how significant that is.
It's remarkable. It's 300,000 working adults who will have access to health insurance who did not have it before as a result of these three votes. There's another vote in Montana to do the same thing that failed. But one of the things that's really remarkable, I mean, these are states that we consider pretty red states. They voted for Trump by overwhelming margins. They, you know, the big gains for Democrats in the House on Tuesday night were not in Utah, Idaho, and Nebraska, and yet we see a key tenet, not just like a abstract progressive idea, but a component of the Democratic Party's signature Obama era agenda being enacted through just a popular ballot initiative. That indicates to me that there are a lot of people who want to see not just progressive ideas in the Democratic Party, but want to see basic problems that ordinary people face every day addressed by the political system, and do not see that happening within the partisan system in Washington. And clearly, the reason we're not getting that in Washington is because the Republican Party has taken a line on healthcare, which is not only against the old talking points about socialized medicine, but to some extent has really, when you look at the way they've opposed Obamacare, is really against the concept of insurance itself. And this is just getting into a place where you cannot address social problems with this kind of belief system. And it's not actually the belief system shared by Republican voters in overwhelmingly Republican states. So to me, that suggests that there's a great deal of opportunity for political change to take place in this country. It just may not be taking place quickly enough at the national level in Washington, D.C.
Well, your headline really says it all, Zach. Red state voters like Democratic ideas much more than Democratic candidates. From Florida to Missouri to Utah, progressive ballot measures won as their advocates lost. How does the party fix that? What are your thoughts? What did you find out doing your research and interviewing people for this piece?
Well, it's tricky. Anytime you're talking about partisanship in the United States and the evolution of the development of the Democratic Party into what used to be called Liberal Party and the Republican Party into a conservative party, you have to address race. Particularly in the 2018 election, I mean, Donald Trump framed this national election by demagoguing on this supposedly nefarious caravan of people coming to the United States from Central America. It's a pretty openly racist act of demagoguery by the president to frame the choice in this election. That was the way the Republican Party leadership wanted you to understand what was at stake in 2018. And yet, a lot of ballot initiatives ended up expanding. Certainly in Florida, there's a voting rights case in Florida, which is essentially a civil rights issue for black men in Florida, first and foremost. By restoring voting rights to, I believe, 1.2 million convicted felons in Florida, this is a major civil rights gain for black men in Florida. And yet, at the same time, the campaign between Andrew Gillum and Ron DeSantis was one of the most overtly racist campaigns in a very racist election season. And so you see voters doing sort of two different things at the same time. I mean, it looks like that gubernatorial race is headed to a recount. It's very, very close. But certainly the idea of restoring voting rights to black men in Florida was much more popular than an actual progressive black candidate. I think Americans are complicated and not monolithic, and they don't lend themselves easily to super simple explanations. But it's very clear that there is an opportunity for the Democratic Party to make gains in places where they have traditionally not been playing. Particularly, even states like Utah, Idaho, and Nebraska.
And this will restore 1.2 million voting rights will be restored to 1.2 million people. with a record in Florida. That's a game changer. We've been talking about that all week. Zach Carter is a senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post. Eric Pape is a veteran journalist. He is overseeing Capital and Maine special projects on the cost of living in California. It's called Priced Out, the crushing cost of living in California. And after a break, we will speak with Eric about that. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@klw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, 1A with Joshua Johnson. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today it is our media roundtable. We are speaking with Zach Carter, senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post, joining us from Brooklyn. Eric Pape is a veteran journalist who's overseen Capital and Maine special projects on the cost of living in California. He's joining us from Culver City, where it's very, very smoky, really northern and southern California. There's just so much smoke. And if you'd like to join us, there's so much going on this week. What really stood out for you in the media and the midterms? What about the way that the media are framing the economy? Because Donald Trump decided to continue his racist and xenophobic remarks about immigration, a lot of people in the media said, well, why isn't he talking about this booming economy? Well, it's booming for some people, but not booming for so many people. So what stood out for you in the coverage? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Eric, you oversaw this big package of stories. You wrote one in July called Priced Out, The Crushing Cost of Living in California. And you write that in our increasingly gig-driven economy, we have less and less access to affordable homes, healthcare, paid vacations, or even true career paths. Before we dive in and talk about what you found, what are your thoughts about how the media are covering this sort of booming economy and how they're framing that? And who's really benefiting from this and who's not?
When you talk about the media, I think it really depends which layer of the media you're talking about, right? Whether it's national television, national news, state news. Here in California, I think the cost of living is a little bit of a, it's one of those topics that sneaks up on people. You don't feel it every single day from the beginning. You start to feel it as a problem when it becomes a problem, and sometimes you don't even notice it right away. I did a multi-year project on the cost of living in the state of Hawaii before doing this for Capital in Maine, and everybody in Hawaii knew it was expensive. They just didn't have a sense of why, and they didn't have much time to think about the long-term implications of it. So I got back to California, which is where I grew up, and found a similar phenomenon bubbling up. Everybody feels the incredible tension from it, but they don't always have the time to step back and think about it too much because you're hustling to pay your bills. So it's sort of like a slow suffocation in a way, economically speaking. I think that now in California, there's actually quite a bit of very good coverage on the subject from a lot of different angles because the problem has gotten so bad. California is generally deemed to be one of the most expensive, if not the most expensive, after Hawaii of all states in the United States, and the media ecosystem in the state has definitely taken to it. I think the elections that just happened helped to galvanize some attention on that. But I think it's just become one of the biggest topics in the state, something that readers will feel is palpable. A lot of the other threats to people that might guide them, whether it's security or whether it's climate change, can feel a bit more abstract than the bills you're paying at the end of each month. So it's hard to complain about that coverage. I'd like to see more of it, and I'd like to see a greater diversity digging into different elements of the state. But I think everybody knows that housing is unbelievably expensive. And so there's a lot to explore there and to lay bare.
And I appreciate that you look at the why, you know, why and how did this happen? First off, since you did this piece and the series in Hawaii last year, what did you find there when you spoke with people? What are the main factors happening in Hawaii?
So I actually did the project in Hawaii from 2013 until 2015. And what I found there in the big picture is that people were about a half step down in the economic ladder from where they thought they were. So if you thought you were upper middle class based on your income, you probably are living actually a standard middle class existence. And if you thought you were middle class, you were living a struggling lower middle class existence. And if you thought you were lower middle class, you were actually pretty much working poor. And I mean that in terms of the life you could afford, the security that you have, how likely you would be to lose your house, or if you had to move because you were evicted, how likely you would have to move off the islands because the costs of current market rents were so high. I think that was one of the big takeaways. And it was there's an element of shame when people are struggling with the cost of living. This applies there and this applies here. People feel, you know, life can be seen as sort of a game of Monopoly in the United States. And people feel like they're losing, and so they feel embarrassed, and they don't realize, they don't tend to realize when it is something bigger than themselves, that the forces working against them have actually changed enough that it's extremely hard for them to get by, and that may not change until there's some bigger change that's far beyond their decision-making.
Zach, you've spent a lot of time writing about economic issues and inequality and poverty. What are your thoughts about really looking at the why question, how we really got here, policy decisions, for example?
Yeah, I like that you said inequality there, because you know what Eric's talking about there isn't just an insufficiency of funds on behalf of, working people. It's an overabundance of funds with especially people who are able to make a lot of money through financial assets and then bid up the prices of everything else. And when you look at places like California or New York, where I live, you have in each case, particularly the Bay Area, some very well-heeled and wealthy professionals who can afford to have to pay a lot of money for housing, and that bids up the cost of housing. So it's a problem. It's not a problem that can be solved by a rising tide that lifts all boats. All that does is just perpetuate the inequality between people who that we currently see, and that's a product of policy choices. Inequality doesn't just fall out of the sky. People end up, we have policies that direct wealth into the community into the hands of particular sets of people, and we do that through trade policy, we do that through financial policy, we do that through tax policy. I think most of the time in the United States we talk about tax policy because it's you don't have to be an expert in the market structure of agriculture to see who's getting taxed at what rates. But the fact of the matter is the way markets are structured themselves directs large amounts of money into the hands of a small number of people. And unless you do something about that, you're going to keep seeing this kind of result.
Right, because this is happening in many parts of the country. Name the big city, and it's so difficult for people who are working jobs like teaching, social workers, cleaning, you name it. It's hard for them to afford their housing.
I think you can go beyond that, actually.
Eric,
it's hard for many lawyers.
Yeah, that's true.
In Hawaii, it's hard for doctors. It's people who we never dreamed it could be that hard for. Mm-hmm. And as for the rising tide that lifts all boats, this rising tide is not lifting all boats. That's a big part of the problem. Mm-hmm. It's making certain boats go soaring up into the sky, and other boats are staying about equal. Incomes over the last 30 or 40 years for many people have been stagnant or declined. And that is versus costs that have been shooting up in healthcare and housing and in some other areas. But there's one other thing. I don't just want to put it all on the issues of equality, of economic equality. There's a big problem in California with cities not having built for the populations that they would have. And it's not a sudden surprise. We look at demographics and we can see who is going to be at the age to look for housing many, many years in advance. And there are many people in California that have fought nail and tooth against the sort of construction that cities needed here.
That's a huge part of the problem as millennials get to the age where they would naturally be moving out if they could afford to, and many of them can't. So part of the series is focused on the many obstacles people have put up that we're now seeing problems as a result of.
Eric Pape is a veteran journalist overseeing Capital and Maine's special projects on the very high cost of living in California. Zach Carter is a senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. And we are trying to connect with Farnaz Fasihi, an award-winning journalist with the Wall Street Journal, to talk about how U.S. sanctions are affecting Iran and Iranians. And so hopefully we'll connect with her in just a couple of minutes. So let's talk about how we unpack this, because now the midterms are over and you definitely have some progressive Democrats that have won their election. Progressives who believe in a higher wage, even higher than the $15 wage, because in many parts of the country, you can't get by on $15 an hour. They believe in universal health care. They believe in free college tuition. They believe in higher taxes. In fact, Peace Action put out a report. This wasn't getting much attention at all during election season. But a lot of people want to end the wars. They oppose massive military spending. So now that we have these people in office, let's talk about how we move forward, talking about actual policies to tackle these problems. Eric, in your reporting, what did you hear from people about actual solutions to these problems and how they can get past, how we can actually see these things happen?
Well, I think the solutions, it's an area by area thing. The solutions are obviously very different for our electric bills and our fuel bills than they are for our medical bills and our housing bills. I think the biggest thing that I would suggest is that politicians start to push in a genuine and authentic way. Start to put sort of normal working and middle class people's concerns at the forefront of their decision making process. It shouldn't drive every single decision. Sometimes you invest in the future, and it's worth investing some money in something to make the future better. But I don't think that they commonly put themselves in the shoes of people who are struggling to pay their bills, in the shoes of people who no longer have pensions and retirements to look forward to, in the shoes of people who think they're going to work forever because they can't afford to retire. And reality gets in the way of that because family members get sick or the people themselves get sick. And then they're going to become burdens on society, in fact, and that's going to have a huge cost. So in that sense, it's actually just terrible planning on the part of the people who are governing. Mm. And I think that they just feel overwhelmed by the issue, and it's one of those issues that they can just put off and put off and put off. And if we continue to do that, the crisis the cost of living crisis is really going to come home to roost.
Well, and I think this just speaks to the point that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said, who's going to Congress in January. She was talking about all of the millionaires in Washington, D.C., and she said, I was a bartender a year ago. I bought my first couch 2 weeks ago. I just got health care. I know what it's like to really struggle. Eric, did you want to say something there?
Yeah, I was just going to say, even our language around these issues is off, because a millionaire in Washington, D.C. is someone with a two-bedroom house in many parts of the town, if you get my meaning. The amounts of money that we're used to talking about, a millionaire is not a lot of money for a family in a big city, and I don't mean that. It's a lot of money to earn. It's a huge amount of money to earn, and it's a huge burden that's virtually impossible for most people. But in terms of what it actually buys, in cities where there are good incomes, if you're a millionaire in San Francisco, by that I mean someone with $1 million, you're living in a small apartment if you just bought it at market rent.
Right. So, if you can find one for $1 million.
Yeah. So the typical house there is over $1.6 million right now.
Right.
The typical condo is well over $1 million as well.
Yeah. No, you're right. It's a good point. What are your thoughts on that, Zach?
Well, I think in Washington, at least, at the national level, there has been not a lot of interest from progressive thinkers and interest groups on issues of market structure and the way that the financial system affects the rest of society. People paid attention to the financial system after the financial crisis of 2008. they could see what happens when the financial system was working very badly, right, when it wasn't working. But they couldn't, they didn't, there wasn't a whole lot of discussion about what it does when it's just working properly. And the bottom line is that if you do not have access to some form of capital income, whether it's real estate rents, the ability to borrow money because real estate values are going up, or stocks and bonds, life is just difficult. It is insecure. The only real way to get any sort of financial foothold and predictability about your future is have access to capital income. And that's because we structure our markets so that a few winners in every market end up getting outstanding returns. And if you own stock in that company, then you will get some flow of income from that. But most people don't have access to capital income. That's the whole point. I think 22% of Americans own more than $10,000 in stock through any vehicle, through retirement funds, through a mutual fund, through a pension, whatever. That's just a way of restating what economic inequality is. So there's a basic problem with the disconnect between the way we produce things, you know, whether it's a good like food or a product like a furniture or a service like being a doctor, and then the people who are in charge setting the agendas for people who are doctors and producers. The income from these activities is not spread among the public in ways that that are equitable, and that's been sort of defined away by the political system as something that is not a problem. That there will be a rising tide that lifts all boats. So long as we have enough economic growth, these problems will take care of themselves. And I think what we've seen is that that's just not true.
And Zach, your colleague Scott Atkinson wrote a piece recently called "Factory Jobs Are Not Coming Back to Cities Like Flint, Whatever Trump Says. A job that was taken by a robot 30 years ago is just not coming back."
I mean, there's truth to that. If the jobs are even lost to automation, but a lot of what we talk about with automation is overstated. I'll put it that way. If you look at the way that economists measure the sort of rate or the pace of automation is just through a metric called productivity. And if you look at productivity over the last 15 years, it's been trending downwards. So the idea that we face a real apocalypse because there are too many robots and there won't be enough work, I don't put a whole lot of stock in that. I mean, you have had technological shocks in the past, and people still have things to do. There can be a brief period of sort of adjustment, the Industrial Revolution, all these things in the past. But it's not even obvious right now that we're on the brink of some sort of transformational change. This is something that people get hooked on when they hear from, Silicon Valley people pitching their new apps and stuff. There's just not a lot of evidence in the economy that that's actually happening right now. What we have are policies that say, whatever it is that you make, all of the income from that is going to go to a few people. If you're the person who owns the app rather than the person who codes the app, life works out differently for you. And that is a policy question. That's a political question. It's not just the way the world has to work.
Well, that was a quote in the piece that your colleague wrote. He also points out that the job decline in the U.S. saw 6 million manufacturing jobs disappear from 2000 to 2010, a third of the sector's total. Hardest hit were the Rust Belt states. Michigan alone lost 440,000 of these jobs. Well, I just want to let listeners know that Farnaz Fasihi is not going to be able to join us. She was going to talk about sanctions in Iran. Hopefully we can get her back next week, and you can find her reporting at yourcallradio.org. We're speaking with Zach Carter with the Huffington Post and Eric Pape with Capital in Maine. He's overseeing their project on the cost of living. Can you both stick around for the next 10 minutes?
Yep.
Okay.
Sure.
Thank you so much. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Greg in Redwood City. Hi, Greg. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I just want to say that I really was kind of appalled by the media coverage with mass shootings nowadays. Basically, with the Philadelphia shooting, I just kept hearing all the thoughts and prayers and then going into burials, and then, we're kind of done. And I'm just like, there's nothing about gun control. There's nothing about the legislation that, the legislators that are voting down legislation that could be helping keep the public safe. And it just infuriates me that I feel like my humanity is being taken from me, that this is supposed to be acceptable behavior. And then on the economic front, you know, like driving around San Francisco and you see that, you know, this is supposed to be the wealthiest part of the country, and the amount of homelessness in San Francisco and Oakland and just all across the country. You know, I just really feel like the media is not covering the true economic reality of the country, and we're going to pay for that.
You know, thank you, Greg. I agree with you. I mean, I was screaming when I heard some of the coverage of this latest shooting. It's just so formulaic. And, you know, we did a show. There's an amazing documentary. I mean, it's awful. It's sad, but it's so important. And if you have time over the weekend, it's from Brave New Films, called Making a Killing, Guns, Greed, and the NRA. And it follows the money, which is so important because this is such a profitable industry. The NRA gives pennies to politicians, and they refuse to take action on this. We had Lois Beckett on our show on election night. She was with the students in Parkland in Florida and their parents. She said they were devastated that people across the country would vote for politicians who refused to do anything about gun control. So I thank you for calling, Greg. I completely agree with you. Well, on the question about the economy, Eric, how do you think reporters should deal with what we're facing? Because every day you hear on the radio, the Dow is up. You know, stocks, I mean, the amount of money people are making is so obscene. When you look at tech companies, their stocks are off the charts in the hundreds and hundreds of dollars. How should journalists approach that, this whole notion that the economy is booming, manufacturing is coming back, but then look what you're seeing on the streets of San Francisco.
So I
and
biggest,
New York and L.A.
Yeah, and other cities that are not the iconic,
right,
you know, mega cities. This is a problem that stretches all across the country and hits many points in between. This is not just an East Coast, West Coast phenomenon. I think that there's a couple of layers to this. One is that we've lived through an era that's seen the devaluing of the work of most working people. And usually there's sort of a tug of war that goes towards, you know, shareholders and work, and then back to workers and then back to shareholders. And something in that equation in the last few decades has been breaking for many, many workers around the country, and it's sort of gradually climbing up the economic food chain and nabbing more people and devaluing more of their work. The more that the money goes to the people who aren't actually doing the work of creation, you know, the worse that phenomenon is getting. And so for what journalists should be doing, I think that they need to tell the human stories that make that clear, because people like to think that they are affected by data and they're affected by numbers and statistics. And in fact, the thing that connects with people and gets them to think about the data, numbers and statistics is the human stories of people getting affected. It's part of why, as part of the series, I wrote a story about my own father, who was a gardener and a gardening supervisor for the LA City Schools. And the reason that I wrote this story, which is, you know, it mixes in my childhood memories, along with a look at where someone like him was back in the 1970s and 80s, and then where that same person, if there was a new version of my dad today, the unbelievable struggles that they would face, because my dad was able to support a family of five and buy a house and then buy a different house. He had a good middle-class existence. And someone similar to him would be working poor now. So my solution, which is what I tried to put into play, is to say, look, here is a human story. Here's how the equation has changed over a period of decades. And I don't think it's the America that people thought they were in for a long time. I don't think the America that, you know, the place we're living right now is quite where many people hoped we were going. And I actually think that's a big opportunity for politicians who are going to think differently and put normal people at the forefront rather than just talking about it. But that's one part. Another part for journalists and media is to lay bare the big picture stuff. And that it's a different exercise, but the big picture issues, diving into legislation, diving into economic policy, and diving into how companies are skirting various rules and laws. That's another crucial layer, harder to make it accessible to people across the country, but that just means you have to be that much more creative in your search for solutions.
It's such a good point. My dad was a union sheet metal worker who had great benefits, and he still has them as a retired. There's no way he would have that today. I mean, his friends who are younger, they're just trying to get by, getting jobs and trying to find work. What about capitalism here, Zach? I mean, after Occupy, you had media outlets across the board actually having a conversation about capitalism. We just got an email from Tim who says, we've come to the point where we're willing to sacrifice citizens for gun profits. And then he's talking about the destruction of the environment. He says capitalism has gone feral and needs to be put down. What about that, Zach?
Well, you know, I think the way people use the word capitalism is itself an interesting phenomenon. It certainly differs between people by age. I think among people my age and younger, when they talk about capitalism, they are talking about severe inequality and ostentatious displays of wealth. That, you know, there's a problem with this sort of class of people that we used to call millionaires and billionaires. I think, as Eric has pointed out ably, you know, not even millionaires are included in this class sometimes. But there's this sort of phenomenon of wealth, a class of people who are so wealthy that they are sort of socially and politically breaking away from the rest of the democratic community. I mean, democratic, small d, like the country, not a partisan connotation. Where they just increasingly aren't subject to the same sort of norms of behavior, the same types of social accountability that the rest of us are. And if you want to call that phenomenon capitalism, then that's a very serious problem for any political project. If you're trying to do something that is democratic, in which you know, some people, everybody is subject to the same rules and norms, and people are trying to govern themselves, and some people are not really just not part of that political community, that's a serious problem. I think candidates like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from Queens and Bronx here in New York, talking about democratic socialism explicitly, I think has maybe sharpened that that distinction for a lot of people. But I still think it's kind of up in the air what people want when they talk about alternatives to capitalism. And I think one of the major sort of political ideological sort of definitional fight that's going to happen over the next 10 years is sort of redefining what we mean when we talk about capitalism and talking about how to change that set of circumstances, whatever you want to call it, into something that's more democratically accountable, something that's more socially accountable.
Well, we're going to do a week-long series on that either next month or in the new year. Zach Carter is a senior political economy reporter with the Huffington Post. Zach, as always, thanks for your work. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Eric Pape is a veteran journalist overseeing Capital & Main's special project on the cost of living in California. And if you want to read his series on Hawaii, just head over to Civil Beat and do a search for Eric Pape. Eric, thank you for joining us. I hope you and your friends and family and everyone are safe and healthy down in Southern California. Thanks for your work.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We just got an email from Raymond who says, there is a panel discussion next Wednesday at UC Berkeley starting at 7:30 p.m. It's called Basic Needs Security Panel. 39% of Cal undergrads and 23% of grad students are experiencing hunger. How can policymakers alleviate this barrier? And Raymond writes, can you imagine this happening in Berkeley? How long ago would this news announcement have been inconceivable? Well, if you'd like to attend this, if you're in the area, it's at UC Berkeley next Wednesday, 7:30 p.m. Thanks to Malihei Razazan for producing today's show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.